Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a responsive day for the 17th of Shvat. And this is a responsive of Cook's, and it's about when we can get halachic information from heaven. Now, the tshuva starts with a technical issue and a technical question, but then Rav Cook gets into these really interesting discussions of when and whether we can accept divine inspiration as a source of halachic information. So you might have to sort of bear with me a little bit at the beginning of the discussion because it's about halacha, but fairly technical halachot. And then we get into the really cool stuff about what Rav Cook is going to claim. This is from Mishpat Kohen, which is a set of a book of responsa that were dealing with issues of Eretz Yisrael. It's from Siman Sadi Bet, from responsive number 92, from the 17th of Shvat of Tafresh Sadi Dalid of 1934. Rav Cook is writing to Rav Avadya Hedaya, who was the author, a very well-known author, of a series of books called Yaskil Avdi. So he's a respected halakhic authority of his own. And Rav Cook writes that he saw that there's another man who I don't know, Mohariel Zurihan, who had commented on something Rav Cook had said. And so then he said, and along the way, I looked at your Yaskil Avdi. And I have to comment on the fact that you were surprised by something. This is what you're surprised. The Rambam, at the end of Hilchos Maaseh HaKorbanot, at the end of the laws of offering sacrifices, writes that today, somebody who, if today, let's suppose a Jew decided for whatever reason to sacrifice an animal outside of the Beit HaMikdash, meaning there's a whole complicated discussion about what happens if you can sacrifice in the Makom HaMizbeach, in the place where the Mizbeach was. If you knew that, we don't know it today. If you sacrifice that, so you'd be liable. So you could sacrifice there, but you sacrifice anywhere else in the world, so that's called shchut echut. It's offering a korban outside of the place where it's supposed to be. So the Rambam writes that you're chayef for shchut echut, the fisher ra'i lavo bifnim, that you can offer it because it's ra'i, it is possible to offer it in the proper place. So Rav Avadya Hedaya had apparently said, I don't understand, why doesn't the Rambam say that the people are tameh, they're tameh zav, and therefore they couldn't possibly bring it inside, and therefore they're not roy. In other words, so this is a technical issue that's at hand. The technical issue at hand is, why don't you say that even if somebody were to offer, let's say somebody in New York were to offer a sacrifice to Hashem, you wouldn't make them liable. We wouldn't understand them to be liable for shkut echot. We wouldn't understand them to be liable for having offered sacrifices out to the Beit HaMikdash because they weren't able to bring them inside. Because the halacha seems to be that you're only liable for shkut echot, for offering animals, for slaughtering animals, korbanot, sacrifices outside the Beit HaMikdash, or for offering them outside the Beit HaMikdash if they were roi to come to be offered inside the Beit HaMikdash. So one reason why there not roy is that we think that people today are tmeim in all sorts of ways, including ziva, and we don't have a way of getting rid of that, so therefore you should say they're not roy. So it seems like the Rabbah assumed that Rav Avadya Hedaya assumes, says Rav Cook, that if the owners of a sacrifice aren't roi lefnim, can't themselves bring it inside, that would be considered part of not being roi levo lefnim. That would be considered part of the whole sacrifice. Can't, and therefore, they'd be not liable for shkut echut, not liable for sacrificing it outside of the Beit HaMikdash. So Rav Cook says that can't be right. It's not true. He says it's not true, and it can't be true because there's a Mishnah in Zvachim on Daf Kuf Yud Bet Amud Bet that says that the whole issue of not being roi, of an animal, of a sacrifice not being able to be brought bifnim, brought in the Beit HaMikdash, is something like a mechusar zman, that the animal has been born, hasn't lived long enough. The animal is meaning the first, when an animal is born, there's a few days before they can be offered as animal. That would be mechusar zman begufo, or the balim, not the balim, or the person who actually offers it, right, the kohen who produces it, is not roy in some way. But, says Rav Cook, that the owners of it, right, are not roy loveth name. I'm sorry, there's something unclear to me in this tshuva, but I want to go on because you don't have time to get into it. But Rav Cook is drawing distinction between the animal itself, which is clearly, if it's not roi, then you wouldn't have a problem with shindichutz. But if the owners, even if the people who are offering it aren't roiyim for some other reason, I think that's what he means. He thinks if it's the mechusar zman issue for some reason in the balim, so that would be something like a mitzora who hasn't waited long enough, I think. He means that would be not roi. But just the fact that they're not roi for some extraneous reason, so we don't have any such rule that would say that you'd be potter from shkut echutz. Right, and the Mishnah says explicitly that when we talk about mechusar zman, about the owners, we mean that they have some particular tumah, like zav and zava, or a yoled, a woman who gave birth and is not allowed to bring korbanot until the end of a certain period after she gave birth, or a mitzor, somebody who has tzara'at, who's offered his chatat and asham in bachut, so he's not ready yet to go in. So those would be examples of not roi. But it's not a general idea of not roi, because that psul, that reason that they can't come, is directly related to the sacrifice. Right, so that's why it's called the Mechuser Zman that's relevant to it. But if they, at the same time, were to offer other sacrifices, right, it's a sacrifice related to that tumah that they can't bring. That's what that's the word of Cook is trying to say. That if it's a problem in the animal, then you wouldn't be liable for Shkutei Chutz. And then, even if it's not a problem in the animal, if it's a problem in the Baalim, but if the problem in the Baalim is directly related to the sacrifice that's being brought, so a zav isn't finished being in his zav yet, or a mitzora is not yet finished being a mitzora and tries to bring a sacrifice bachutz outside the Beit Mikdash, then they wouldn't be liable because it's not a valid sacrifice to their mechuser zman. But if that same person in that same time period brings an ola, a burnt offering outside the Beit Mikdash that has no relevance to his status as a zav, then he'd be chayav shkutei chutz, says Rav Cook. So that's Rav Cook's fundamental claim. Right, and the reason for that, he says, is that the sacrifice itself could have been brought bifnim. So, in other words, when a zav thinks about bringing his ziva korban, his sacrifice to end his period of being a zav, but he's not yet over his period of being a zav, then the sacrifice itself can't be brought. It's not roi because the owners aren't ready to bring it yet. So that's the issue. There's a flaw in the sacrifice, and that's why if it's offered outside the Beit HaMikdash, Shkutei Chutz, sacrificing it or offering it outside the Beit HaMikdash, is in a category that's relevant. But that same person at that same time who has some other sacrifice that's perfectly reasonable to be brought, the sacrifice itself, so then Rav Cook is certain that Shkutei Chutz would apply, that offering it outside the Beit HaMikdash would apply to that sacrifice. And he says he doesn't understand it because according to Rav Hadai, who thinks that any time that the Be'alim can't bring a sacrifice, that all of the things that they would bring would not have a problem with Shkutei Chutz, then he says it should have to be that the only person who can create Shkutei Chutz is a Kohen. Right? And a male Kohen, and one who doesn't have any woman, meaning somebody who could actually serve in the Beit HaMikdash, because after all, anybody else can't bring the sacrifice in the Beit HaMikdash. But the rule is that the person slaughtering the animal or offering it on an altar has to be roi, has to be able to offer it in the Beit HaMikdash. The only people who can offer this korbanot in the Beit HaMikdash are Kohanim, without any physical differences from other Kohanim, and males only. So the whole category of Shkutei Chutz, of slaughtering a sacrifice outside the Beit HaMikdash, or offering it, shouldn't apply to anybody except for Kohanim. And we know that's not true, because first of all, the Pasuk says, Ish ish mi beit Yisrael mina gerash yagur b'tochachem. Any man from among the Jewish people, or somebody, a stranger who lives amongst you, and there's a Medrash Halacha in Torah's Kohanim that says that doesn't mean non-Jews, it means whatever it means. Rav Cook says, if you, Rav Hadaya, think that when we talk about an Einer Roi, somebody who's not able to bring a sacrifice, as not being able to also violate the problem of Shkutei Chutz, then there's no reason to lead to for a special miut, for a special verse to be clear that this doesn't include non-Jews. Of course it doesn't include non-Jews. It doesn't include non-Jews, it doesn't include regular Jews, and yet the verse seems to include regular Jews. And it says there explicitly in the Torah's Kohanim and the Torah itself that Gerim count and Avadim and slaves count. Right, and in Ha'ala'a, and when it comes to offering it outside the Beit HaMikdash, it speaks specifically of women and slaves as well. So why would the Pesukim have to say that if they're not Roi? So Rav Cook says, so I think this whole idea that you read a Gemara that talks about being Roi, he says, I think you read it mistakenly. I think the point of Roi is that they have to be worthy of the, they have to be able to offer the sacrifice itself, meaning not that they themselves have to be able to offer it, but it has to be a sacrifice that could be offered now, and that if the owners have something wrong with them, that this sacrifice couldn't be offered now. So, for example, a sacrifice to mark the end of a period of being a mitzvah, to mark the end of the period of a woman's recovery from childbirth, the sacrifice that she brings, if she offers that, anybody offers that sacrifice outside the Beit HaMikdash before it would have been the right time to bring it in the Beit HaMikdash, there's not going to be a problem with Shkutei Chutz because it's not Roy. But that same woman at that same time, that same man at the same time, if they offered other sacrifices in that time outside the Beit HaMikdash, says Rav Cook, even though they themselves could not have entered the Beit HaMikdash. That's not an issue. That's not the thing. So that's the technical part of our discussion. Rav Kook is bringing up the question of what considered Roi, because we have this idea in the Mishnah and in the Gemara that somebody who's not Roi can't be liable for Shkutei Chutz. Rav Avadya Hadayah seems to have understood that to mean they're not Roi because there's something wrong with them, such, so for example, they're a Zav, and therefore they couldn't enter the Beit HaMikdash, and therefore all the sacrifices, this is what Rav Hadayah seems to have understood, all the sacrifices they would have offered that they might offer outside of the Beit HaMikdash cannot count as Shkutei Chutz because they themselves are not Roy. Says Rav Kook, that can't be right. The whole idea in the Gemara is only for those sacrifices related to the thing that invalidates them. So yes, if today somebody offered a sacrifice for the end of his Ziva period, so we would say today people are considered Zavim, and therefore and they don't get rid of that status as Zavim, and therefore it's not Roy. That's true, but any other sacrifice they offer would still be a problem. And Rav Kook expresses this as a surprise. Rav Hadayah seems to not have understood this when it seems like obvious to anybody who just learns a little bit of Gemara. Meaning he doesn't think this is a deep insight into the Gemara. This is a clear, simple way to read the Gemara, and a big Talmud Chacham like Rav Hadayah seems to have made that mistake. So Rav Kook is surprised by that. Then this other party to this discussion, this Rav Yudchad Zrian, so Yosef Chaim Zrian, I don't know who it is. So, but in any case, this man had said that Makom HaMizbeach is Eino Me'akev. The fact that we don't know where the Mizbeach was exactly doesn't mean that we couldn't offer sacrifices today, and therefore that you couldn't have a problem Shkutei Chutz today, right? The problem they were discussing was Shkutei Chutz. Let's say we offered a sacrifice somewhere, and it's outside the Beit HaMikdash. So that's usually a problem. So you might have said, well, if we don't know where anything is, we can't offer any sacrifices today, then none of our sacrifices are Roi, could be brought, and therefore there shouldn't be today a violation of the problem of Shkutei Chutz. So this Bariach Zrihan says, even if we don't know the exact place of the Mizbeach, it's still true that there is an area that we could offer real sacrifices, and therefore Shkutei Chutz should apply. And therefore the problem of offering sacrifices to the Beit HaMikdash should apply. Why does he say that? Because there's a tradition that Shlomo HaMelech, when he built the first Beit HaMikdash, was Mikadesh the whole Ritzpah. He sanctified the entire floor of the Beit HaMikdash for sacrifice. I think that's because, my memory is that's because they had too many sacrifices to offer on the Mizbeach all at once at the same time, and therefore he was Mekadesh the whole Ritzpah, and that gave him more area in which to offer the sacrifices than into which to slaughter the sacrifices than to offer them later or at that time. So Rav Kook says that can't be right. And part of the reason why he thinks that can't be right is that we have a Gemara in Zvachim Matzamach Bet Amin Aleph says that three prophets came back from Bavel after the first exile. One gave testimony for them. As a prophet said, this is where the Mizbeach was. And the Gemara says, I can get how they knew how to shape the house because you know the diagram of it. But how did they know all those years later exactly where the Mizbeach was, exactly where the altar was? And the answer they give there in the Gemara is that they saw in a prophetic vision Mizbeach Banui, an altar built, and Michael, the great angel, offering sacrifices. Or, according to Rabbi Yitzchak Nafcha, they saw the ashes of Yitzchak there in the right place for the Mizbeach. That would be a reference back to the Akedah. Yitzchak was once upon time bound on that very spot. Later he passed away, but they saw ashes of that burning in that place, and that's what told them this Navi, whoever the Navi was, meaning whichever one of them was the Navi who did it, told them where to put the Mizbeach. Or, like another opinion there is, Rav Shmuel Bar Nachmani, I think, says another answer. Whatever the answer is. But, says Rav Kook, what's the whole effort there in the Gemara and Zvachim? According to this Mariach Zrian, the whole Ritzpah, the whole floor was Mikudash. They didn't need that. Well, it was preferable, but they didn't need it. So we have to say that, no, when Shlomo HaMelech was Mekadesh the Ritzpah, when he sanctified the whole floor in order for them to be able to offer that many sacrifices they need to offer, it was a temporary sanctification, not a permanent one. Which is all interesting claim that Rav Kook does not get into, how you create temporary sanctity and limited sanctity that doesn't go on. We do, anyway. It might have lasted for the whole time of the first Beit HaMikdash, but not beyond there. That's what Rav Kook seems to be saying, just like we think that about other sanctities as well. That you can be Kaddish L'Sha'ata. You can make sanctity for something for as long as that sanctity lasts, but once it gets destroyed, it doesn't last. That's a whole set of conversations we won't get into right now, but they come up in other halakhic areas. So, that's why they needed to have these Nevi'im, these prophets, tell them where things were, including the Makom Mizbeach, because the Makom Mizbeach, as the Rambam passage that we say, has to be Bidiyuk gadol. It has to be very exact. That comes up not only in Rav Kook's time, but later on as well, it comes up because when there's, you know, in the process of watching the unfolding of these remarkable events that we have had the privilege in the last century and a quarter, century and a half to witness, so periodically somebody will say, oh, maybe we can go even further, right? Their excitement and their enthusiasm goes even further, and they say, maybe we can start offering korbanot again, which is a desire of anybody who is halakhically minded, because it's part of the full expression of Judaism, and we know that we can't have the full expression of the religion until we have this as well. And so one of the answers is, no, you can't do it because you need to know where the Mizbeach is. So people say, well, estimate it. So the answer is, Allah has been clear for a long time. You need to know the place of the Mizbeach, B'diyuk Gadol. So they had that Navi to tell them when they came back from Babel, and he set up the Mizbeach, but now we don't know that, and therefore we can't do it. The problem is that we know that in general we say, we don't trust divine information about halakhic issues, right? We have these famous stories. We're going to get to them, so I don't have to repeat them. But trust me, that we'll get to them. There are plenty of examples in the Gemara that say that we don't rely on divine information to shape our current halakhic experience. One of the ways that we justify that is by saying the pasuk in the Torah says "Lo b'shamayim hi," it's not in heaven, and we understand that to mean we no longer, once the Torah was given to Moshe at Har Sinai, it is a human Torah, meaning we have the Torah and we have tradition, and then we have the human intellect to understand it. We don't trust divine things. So another example, that's one example, the Lo b'shamayim hi, and that comes up in a story. I'll tell it now, and when it comes up later, I can refer to it briefly. That's the famous story of Elizabeth Hercules has a disagreement in halacha with all the scholars of his time, and they're arguing back and forth, and he brings all these ways of showing that he's right, and the last of them is he says, if I'm right, they'll say it min ha-shamayim, and they'll tell us from heaven, and a heavenly voice comes out and says, why would you argue with Beth Ben Hercules? He's always right. Notably, the voice doesn't actually say he's right. It says, why would you argue with him? He's always right, which is a different kind of a thing. But there in that story, Rabbi Hoshua says, the verse says, lo ba-shamayim hi. We don't listen to bat calls. We don't listen to heavenly voices about halacha. And therefore, they reject Rabbi Elazar ben Hurkanus. There's a story there in that Gemara. It's in Bava Metzia and Daf Nun Tet. The Gemara goes on to tell the story that somebody met up with Eliyahu later and said, what did Hashem say when they said this? And he said, Nitzkuni banai, my children have defeated me. While there is discussion about whether we pass in this way or not, it does seem like the simplest way to read that Gemara is that after the time of the giving of the Torah, we no longer trust heavenly voices on these issues. So too, there's another Gemara, I think it's in Temura Ted Zayin Amid Aleph, that when Moshe Rabbeinu passed away, the tradition is there were all these halachot, there were hundreds of halachot that were forgotten because they were so distraught over the passing of Moshe Rabbeinu, they forgot various halachot. And so they said to Yehoshua and Pinchas, and to others at other periods of time when their halachos were forgotten, they said, you know, ask, just say to Hashem, we forgot these halachos, can you please repeat these halachos so we can know them again? In other words, we're not asking Hashem to teach us new halachot, that you could say, no, that ended in Matan Torah, but just remind us of what we've forgotten. And the answer that's given in that Gemara is, no, lo b'shamayim hi, you can't because it's not in heaven anymore. And then there's another drasha there in the Gemara which says, Eilah ha-mitzvot, these are the commandments. Hashem says these are the commandments, and the tradition is that means she'ein navi rashai lechadesh davar me'ata, that no navi, no prophet can legislate or can bring in Hashem's name new halachot. Complicated question, because Nevi'im can say, we're going to temporarily violate the Torah, we're going to temporarily do this or this or this, not idol worship ever, or worshiping any power other than Hashem ever, but other things a Navi can do that violate the Torah. But he can't say, the Navi, he or she cannot say, oh, it turns out the Torah changed, such as, obviously the obvious example is, Jesus, right? That's an impossibility from the halakhic perspective, even were it to be true that Jesus was a Navi. If he says, God told me we're going to change the Torah now, that is one of the ways in which a Navi clearly demonstrates that he or she is a false prophet and not a true prophet. So that's the problem for Rav Kook, because how could it be that the Gemara says that these Nevi'im showed them where the place of the Mizbeach was? We say in other places in the Gemara very clearly, we don't trust in a heavenly voice, and they're not allowed to mechadesh, they're not allowed to tell us innovative halachot. There happens to be there's a Tosos in a couple of places that Rav Kook knows that seems to say that it's not clear that we actually pask in that way. It's true that Yehoshua says, and that Gemara ends up ruling against Rav Eliezer ben Hyrcanus. Question is why? So the Tosfos suggests that there they didn't trust the Bat Kol only because the heavenly voice they decided wasn't telling them what they really needed to know, wasn't really telling them what the truth was. It was just honoring Rav Eliezer ben Hyrcanus. So if a voice comes out to honor somebody, then it does, you can't trust its content, right? Or if you're going against the majority, and we have a verse in the Torah that says, no, you follow the majority, right? You had a majority saying one way in that halakhic discussion, and Rav Eliezer was going against them. So there, we can't trust the Bat Kol because it's violating in coming out and saying it. If we were to trust it, it meant what it said. So it's violating its own rules, and that can't happen. So, but Tosfos seems to apply that if heavenly information comes out and gives us information that's not against the Torah that we have already and isn't suspect because it's only coming to honor somebody, then we would trust that Torah. That's a radical claim for the Tosfos, but Rav Kook's going to make it even more radical. He says, well, but then what about the Gemara in Temura, where they didn't ask for the information about what they had forgotten from the time of Moshe Rabbeinu, and they said you can't because lo b'shamayim, that sounds like you can't get any information from heaven, because those were going to be halachot, that were going to be established halachot, just that they had forgotten. So he says, maybe you can say, he says, that what Tosfos meant when they said that, yes, there are occasions when we can rely on information that comes from Hashem, as long as, A, it's not for somebody's honor, and therefore it's suspect, the content is suspect, because we know why it came. It came for a reason that has nothing to do with its content. Or, B, it contradicts the Torah, that you certainly couldn't trust, but let's say it doesn't. Then Rav Kook says, but maybe Tosfos only meant when it comes on its own. Right? Like a bat kol that comes out, like a heavenly voice that comes out and says, follow Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus. So, for example, there's another Bat Kol, very famous, well-known Bat Kol, very famous, heavenly voice, that says the halakha is like Beit Hillel. And that's a Bat Kol that we do seem to follow. So Tosfos struggle with that, and they have all sorts of answers that Rav Kook doesn't get into. But Rav Kook seems to be saying that, no, maybe the answer is we trust that Bat Kol. And the reason we trust that Bat Kol is that it wasn't summoned. First off, it didn't come out to honor anybody in particular. It's not like Beit Hillel were saying, I need this for my honor. There was a debate going on among the sages, and the Bat Kol all of a sudden came out and said, we follow Beit Hillel. That, Rav Kook suggests, Tosfos is comfortable with, because it came out on its own. It wasn't contradicting anything in the Torah, and it wasn't for somebody's honor. But, and this gets back to the Moshe Rabbeinu Halachos question, he says, but you can't ask for them. You can't ask the Lish'ol min HaShamayim. That's not allowed. Once Moshe Rabbeinu came down from Sinai with the Torah, we're not allowed to do that. Moshe Rabbeinu was allowed to do it because he could say to people, listen, I'll ask Hashem, Hashem will tell me. We see that in the Torah. He says, Imdu ve'eshma'a. Stay for a second. What you didn't know, halakhic question, like when they brought back, when the five daughters of Slofchad say they want a place in Eretz Yisrael because their father died without taking possession of it and left no sons, Moshe says, wait a second, I'll ask Hashem. So Moshe Rabbeinu had the confidence that he could be taught the Torah from Hashem, and there you could do it. But in other cases, we're not allowed to ask for it. I think Rav Kook seems to imply because we're not sufficiently certain that we'll get the answer, and therefore we can't do it. And Rav Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, maybe that's also a problem here. He said, heaven should prove it. That was like asking, and that's what immediately disqualified his Bat Kol. Meaning Rav Kook is suggesting that if Rav Eliezer ben Hyrcanus had been arguing against all the other sages, and just they were arguing back and forth, and all of a sudden a voice came out and said, listen, Rav Eliezer ben Hyrcanus is right, that maybe according to that Tosfos, we would listen to it. So, but when he said, they'll prove I'm right from heaven, that was not allowed, and that immediately meant that the Bat Kol, the voice that came out, would not be trusted. So, you end up, this part of the tshuva, he says, so it ends up, even according to Tosfos, meaning according to the Rambam, Rambam's much more hard line on this question. He says, yeah, we don't trust any heavenly voices. That whole realm of knowledge of what Hashem wants as a halachic matter, as a matter of Torah and halacha, is not available to us anymore. Tosfos is more open to it, to Rav Kook says, but even according to Tosfos, there are places where you can't have it, and you're not allowed to get that information from them. So the reason why he's bringing that up now is he comes back to point out to us is because that would mean that today we don't know where the Mizbeach is supposed to be. We don't know where the altar is supposed to be. And that would mean then that we can't offer sacrifices today. That should make all the sacrifices not roi. That should make them not available to be offered. And if they're not available to be offered, that should mean that there can't be a problem shkut yichutz today. That could mean that if somebody offers a sacrifice today or slaughters a sacrifice today outside the Beit HaMikdash, that while it's not good for lots of reasons, it's not a full violation of Shrutei Chutz. Right, so that's the problem. Doesn't that make everybody not Roy and all sacrifices not Roy, and therefore doesn't this halacha not come into place? Rav Kook says, no. He thinks when it comes to matters that have to do with the Beit HaMikdash, we're not only allowed to accept information from heaven, we're allowed to ask for it. And he points to a sifrei, which says on the verse, L'shichnoti drishu vatashama, that you should seek out Hashem's presence and go there, and we can only offer our sacrifice in the place that Hashem chooses. The Sifrei says, Al Pi Navi, by a prophet. The prophet will tell you where. And then the Sifrei says, Yachol Tantina Chiyomar Lecha. Does that mean that you should wait until the Navi comes to you of his own volition? Says, here's where it goes. Tavud Lamar L'shichno Tidrishu. You can seek out the divine presence. Jerosh Umitso. Go and look and seek, and then a prophet will tell you. And he gives an example. God, the prophet, in the time of David, says to David, put a mizbeach in the gorin of Aravna Yehayivusi, on the threshing floor of Aravna Yehayivusi. So Rav Kook says, this, he understands the Sifrei. I don't know that the Rambam quotes the Sifrei, but he understands the Sifrei to mean the Torah is telling us a new halacha, that within the overall rubric that we don't follow divine voices except according to social in certain situations, and we certainly not allowed to seek them out, when it comes to the mizbeach and the placement of the altar, that is always open, even after the time of the giving of the Torah, to Nivuah, and we're allowed to seek it out either by Torah law or by asking a Navi, and that's a new idea. He says that's a new thing, that in general in Inyanei HaTorah, in general in Torah matters, in Torah law, we're not allowed to ask for and seek some kind of metaphysical, divine, prophetic inspiration but we are allowed to accept it according to Tosfot if it's not done for somebody's honor and it doesn't contradict the Torah, but we can't ask for it. But when it comes to the Mizbeach, in fact, he thinks we can even ask for it. We can go to a Navi, we can say, please tell us what Hashem said about the place of the Mizbeach. That's not considered part of this whole issue of that prophets cannot bring new halakhic information. This is all within Tosfos, because the Rambam is against this whole idea. But that's what Rav Kook is suggesting. Now, if that's true, then it means that even though we don't know where the Mizbeach is, it's not impossible for us to figure it out, because as soon as there's a Navi, and that you can always possibly have a Navi. As soon as we find a Navi, we can ask the Navi to tell us where the Mizbeach is, where the altar should be. Then we can build, and then we can offer sacrifices there. So that means that Shkutei Chutz is still a relevant category today, because sacrifices, even today, are considered Roi. This gets into the whole issue of the principle of Kol Roi Labila, of whether something is available to be done or not. And he says, yeah, you can do it. And then he says, not only does he think it can be done by Nevuah, that's full-on prophecy, he thinks even Ruach HaKodesh would qualify. So Ruach HaKodesh is a lower level. The exact definitions are not given here in the Tshuva, and we don't have time to get into it. But he says that explains why we say not that they were told by Hashem where the Mizbeach was, but that the prophet sort of saw ashes of Yitzchak somewhere, or he saw Michael offering on an altar that he sort of saw in this vision, and that's not quite a prophetic vision. It was enough of a revelation from heaven, not quite prophecy, Ruach HaKodesh, but that was enough to rely on to build the Mizbeach on the basis of that. So even today, when we don't have prophets, we still do have Ruach HaKodesh. And then he quotes some Kabbalistic sources that talk about that you still have Ruach HaKodesh. So that can be considered Ro'i. And therefore, we could say that even today, and that's why the Rambam, now he goes back to the Rambam, right? So the Mariach Zrian, it asked about how could it be that a Shochet of Mala today is Chayav, because today it's an Ro'i. It can't be brought. So Rav Kook says, but now it can be. Now he, Rav Kook, I think, sort of elides over the fact that the Rambam doesn't think we have that way of accessing information about where the Mizbeach was. So it's not such a perfect answer for the Rambam, because Rambam doesn't think that we can do it that way. But Rav Kook thinks, in general, we can do it that way. And he says, in the world, there's never lacking. There's a Gemara in Sukkah. There's never lacking for the 36th tzaddikim, the 36 righteous people. And therefore, it's possible at any moment one of those tzaddikim will be inspired and have the insight about where to put the Mizbeach. And therefore, we would be able to rebuild the Mizbeach, which is a fascinating thing, because it means that he thinks that at any moment it could happen. More than that, he says also, he thinks that in any case where you have two sides to a discussion, in a pilpul d'orais, right, they're arguing about something, and each side thinks he has proof from the Torah, and there's an intellectual discussion of it, but we don't know which way it goes. He says he thinks there maybe also you can accept divine inspiration, right? Because that's not a completely new revelation of Torah. And the prohibition was against thinking that you could have completely new revelations of Torah. But if Beit Hillel hold one way, Beit Shammah hold the other way, or any other version of that, any other configuration of people arguing about Torah, so there, when the divine voice would come out and tell us where it is, that's not new Torah, that's just telling us which one of them is the one we should put into practice. So there's a tiny bit more to the tshuva, but we're sort of running out of time, and I want to bring it to a wraps here because those are the pieces of it that I thought were most essential, and this is really the essence of the tshuva, that from a technical discussion about shkut echot and the prohibition of offering sacrifice outside the Beit HaMikdash, Rav Kook, it gets into a discussion that leads us to realization of how radical he understood from a pure halachic standpoint. This is not a philosophical question. This is not, you know, this is not some kind of Jewish thought idea. This is his halachic understanding of how we can regain information about where to place the Mizbeach, and he offers all sorts of possibilities. In Torah in general, he seems to say that if there's a debate among Torah scholars, to define who wins that debate, there might be room to say that we can trust a divine voice. Even if that's not true, he thinks that, according to Tosfot, whenever a voice comes out that doesn't contradict the Torah, and wasn't sought and asked for, and wasn't for somebody's honor, there's room to say that we can follow that, listen to that. And then, most relevant to his conversation right now, his topic right now, he thinks when it comes to matters of the Beit HaMikdash, there is this Sifrei that says the Shichnot to Joshua Vat Hashem, that we're even allowed to ask and seek out such voices to tell us the information, and to give us information we would not have had otherwise. And in those situations, not only are we allowed to ask, and not only would a prophet be good enough, but even Ruach HaKodesh would be good enough, even divine inspiration that's not quite prophetic would be good enough. And that is always possible because there's always at least 36 tzaddikim who are worthy of such divine inspiration, which would mean that theoretically for Rav Kook, if somebody came today and it was the kind of a person who might have such divine inspiration, said, you know, I had a dream last night and I know exactly where on Har HaBayit the ashes of Yitzchak were, Rav Kook might have held, we're here today, that we should follow that and think of that as the place to build the altar. All of which starts with the technical, moves to the visionary, and halakhically relevant, although not yet practical, because we don't yet have those tzaddikim or those Ruach HaKodesh people telling us where to put the Mizbeach. But some ideas about what did we do and don't accept information from non-human intellectual sources to define halakha from Rav Kook from the 17th of Shvat. Have a great day.